We just entered the month of Tammuz, one of the two summer months, and the parsha this week is Korach, the original, if you like, discussion or source of conflict or argument, rebellion. And these are two difficult months, Tammuz and Av. They have the most difficult time in the year, stretched across them. Let's try to look at one of the subjects that's associated at a deeper level with this time of year. And that is the subject, or the subjects at a deep level of seeing and hearing. I think we looked at these from various perspectives before. See if we can add a level. Get a... improve our understanding, see if we can delve a little deeper and understand something new. In the cycle of the months, there's a discussion of the 12 elements, the 12 zodiac elements that the months represent. In the Sefer Yetzirah, great central, early, very early Kabbalistic work, our classic sources attributed to Avraham Avinu, to Abraham, right at the beginning of Jewish history, as the author of that work. That obviously is one of the deepest sources of the inner wisdom or the hidden wisdom that we have, long before the Zohar. And there is a list of the 12 months, list of the months, and what each one corresponds to, the correspondence of each month. The way it's put there, for those who have the particular interest, is that the 12 months of the year are born from, or they extend spiritually from 12 letters in the alphabet. The concept here is that the Hebrew alphabet is the 22 letters are the 22 elements that build all of reality. That's the concept. And when you put these 22 together with the 10 basic spiritual elements in the world, those are the 32 pathways of wisdom, if you like, on which the world is built. But the 22 letters are the 22 elements that spell reality, in other words. The concept, of course, is that the letters are the building blocks of the words. The words are the means of expression or creation, if you like, just like your words are an expression of what your thoughts are unrevealed, your words revealed, bring into the world. So the letters are the elements that construct that process, and therefore the letters are the elements that build reality. And of these letters, the letters are broken down into a series of three, which are primary letters, and then there are seven, which are doubled. Again, it's not our discussion exactly this evening. Seven, three mother letters, if you like. It's wonderful to understand these things, because when you read Hebrew, when you stand a little bit of Lashon Kodesh, of that spiritual language that we call Hebrew, so you can read it with scientific precision. You can understand what's being said, not like another language where you have to know by convention what the words mean. In Hebrew, you can analyze what's being said with chemical specificity. You can actually put together the meanings of the elements. But there are three root elements. There are seven letters that constitute male and female doubles. Those are what are known as Beged Kaporet, the seven Hebrew letters that take a dot, they take a dagesh, bedagesh verofa, that means they can express soft or hard, like base vase, pei fei, etc. The resh also has a dot, very, very occasionally in Tanakh. Those are the seven doubled letters. And then you have a set of 12 that are called chutos. Those are the simple letters, the letters that appear only in one form, 12 letters. And each of them is a root of the 12 expanses, or the 12 dimensions or extensions of the world. All the elements of 12 in the world are born from these 12 letters. The signs of the zodiac, the months, in other words, the construction of physical space, not physical space as such, but the extension of physical space, the sources, sources that talk about this explain that when you bound a space, when you express a space to its full dimensions, then an idealized space is surrounded by 12 lines, what are known in the deeper literature as the Yud-Beis Kaveh Alachson, and the 12 meridia that surround reality. In the idealized space of a cube, you have 12 lines that surround a cube. You have four there, you have four here, and the four lines that bind those facets of the cube, those are four those are the 12 meridia that bound reality. They completely circumscribe a shape, not only the shape, but the particular size. In other words, they're the boundary edges of the shape. Those are the 12 elements that express the expansion of reality, and those are known as the 12 meridia, whatever the correct English word is. Those are the elements. And all the levels, all the elements of 12 in the world are spelled out, if you like, here. Now, among the parallels of these letters are faculties of the body, of the mind, parts of the body, faculties of the body's ability to express itself, and many other things besides. But what we'd like to extract for now is, if you trace this month's history, if you like, if you trace the derivation of this month, Tammuz, you find that it is corresponding, again, the different versions of the Sefer Yetzirah, different opinions, but in the edition that we have that comes, that agrees, that is consistent, let's say, with the Ari, the great Ari and the Gaon of Vilna, then unlike certain other editions, this month corresponds to the eyes, to seeing. The faculty of sight is carved out by this month. Right? The letter Ches, as it happens, that's the letter, and it carves out the dimension of sight, which is the highest manifestation of human sense. Above the eyes, you have no other sense. Eyes come first. The eyes are the first in the devolution of senses. Above the eyes, really, you have only some very high things. You have the forehead, which is known as the Metzach, which is something even deeper, which is closed. And above that, you have only the fontanelle, which is where the child's brain is open, exposed when it's born. And these all need, obviously, discussion. But the first of the five manifest senses, where the inside can make contact with the outside, that is in sight, in the eyes. That needs thought. What does it have to do with this month? Why does that lead to its being a difficult month? The month in which the classic sin of the golden calf took place, which is the ultimate expression, the classic expression of Avodah Zarah, idolatry. Right, the ultimate sin, if you like, the primal one, the one that subsumes or contains all other negative thoughts and actions in the Torah. That was our downfall when the golden calf was, when that sin was committed. That basically is what led to our remaining in the desert. And of course, we have not yet emerged from that desert of the nations, as it's called, Midbar Ha'amim. We consider still to be in the desert of the nations. What is going on? What is the fault? What is the error? What does it have to do with seeing? Let's see if we can try and put our heads into this deep area and explore a little bit together. See if also we can derive some of the theme that leads to the correction of the problem that's inherent here. First of all, the Tammuz, you know, the word Tammuz is interesting. The names of the months, Aramaic names. Tammuz is a name, a Babylonian name. And the history of this month is interesting. The Rambam says that the name Tammuz, actually was the name of a person. He was a prophet of idolatry. The Rambam actually has a lengthy description of the history, based on a verse in Yechezkel, where it says that the women sat and wept. They lamented the Tammuz. They wept, they mourned, over the death of this Tammuz. And they said, the women said, that now that we no longer able to sacrifice to this God, we lack everything. Chasarnu kol, we lack everything. You know, the word kol in Hebrew, you have to understand always on more than one level here. To say we lack everything because we can't worship idols, the word kol in Hebrew, simply translated, means everything. We lack everything. But kol is always a key in the deeper wisdom for the correct spirituality. The word kol in Hebrew means everything. So here you have already a clue in the meaning of the word. To say everything, the concept of everything, of totality, is not relevant in a world of finite limitation. Everything always means that which transcends the world. In the world you can't have everything. Even if you have the whole world, it's not everything. The world is limited, inherently limited. To say everything, the completely transcendent notion of all things, of everything, is always transcending the world. Only spiritual perfection can talk in those terms. And the classic example of this is when Esau comes to meet Yaakov. Right? Esav is the man who expresses physical power in the world. He comes with 400 men. 400, the Maharal says, is always the full expanse of physical reality. Not going to go now why that is. He comes against Yaakov, the ultimate, the cosmic battle, the precursor of the ultimate showdown between Yaakov and Esav. Brothers, should be brothers. Esav comes towards him and he says, Yesh li roiv, I have much. He measures himself in terms of his might and his power. I have much. And Yaakov, the spiritual man, answers him, Yesh li kol, I have everything. In fact, he had... The point is not whether he had a lot or a little, but if you say everything, the word everything is just as far from a lot as it is from a little. Everything is the world of perfection, that's the world of shleimus, the world of transcendence. You can only say you have everything when you live spiritually. It doesn't matter if you have a lot or a little, is the point. And therefore, the word kol always means that which is higher. Secondly, the word kol adds up to 50. Kol adds up to 50. 50 always means the transcendence. 49 is always the levels of reality. And 59, we've shared this idea together so many times by now. Should be, I'm sure, clear to everyone. That 50 is always that which is beyond number. We count 49 days of Sphira, which are the 7 times 7 levels of the natural world. And the 50th is always beyond counting. We don't count that day. Even though the Torah says count it. But we observe that mitzvah of counting by not saying a number. Because 50 is beyond number. And that's what kol means. So these people lamenting the Talmud, what they're saying was that now we have... Yeah, you see, this is the counterpoise here. Idolatry and what it stands for, and spiritual perfection on the other hand, which is that which completely transcends all measure. Who was this Talmud? So the Rambam brings that Avraham Avinu, Abraham, when he started his quest for spirituality in the world, and he began to battle against the false belief, and I say belief because there was only one. There was one unified idolatrous belief in his day. He battled, just like he began the book that became Torah, so he battled against the document that documented a pagan Babylonian idolatrous notion. And the Rambam spells it out. He says there was a man called Tammuz. He was a prophet of this idolatry. He was, the Rambam goes into detail, he was killed in a bizarre fashion by the king of those times. And in response that night, what happened was that the idol of this particular worship, which was fashioned in the shape of the sun and was suspended midway between heaven and earth, it came and poised over the temple of that particular time, and all the gods in the world, all the idols in the world gathered around, and they all cried all night, and eventually it fell and crashed. And a long story about this idolatrous event. You can look it up yourself. He goes into detail. He names it, in fact, what the belief was. And the result was a mourning over this Tammuz, his name was Tammuz, and the women wept over that, and that's what's being described here. There's a deep connection here with the concept of idolatry, which, as we've shared here before together, is the idea that idolatry is not going in the wrong direction. Idolatry doesn't mean thinking that something that's carved in stone or fashioned out of wood is the creator of the world. It happens to be idolatrous too, but before it's idolatrous, it's silly. No, they're silly. You're not talking about... Idolatry is going to the right source, but not going far enough. The correct understanding of idolatry is people who correctly perceived forces that are genuine forces, but instead of perceiving the unifying force behind all of those, they stuck at the level of the independent individual issues. They went to the sun and the moon and the wind, and above all, they went to the stars. They went to the stars. The stars, what they call the zodiac, the worship of stars, we call it Akum, Avodas Kechavim and Mazalos. We call it the worship of stars and zodiac. Stars, worship of the stars. We're not yet talking about astrology. We're talking about worship of the stars. Astrology, only one particular facet of that. Some of that's permitted, some of it's not. Not our discussion again. But worship of the stars means, in effect, believing that the stars determine what happens, and beyond that, there's no level beyond that. It means it's all held by the stars. And you speak to them, you have to sacrifice and speak to them. And of course, the subtlety here is that it's correct. Everything does come through that interface with the transcendent world. The furthest you can see is the world of cosmic structure, the world of the stars, stars and planets, 7 planets and 12 stars, 7 classic planets. They extended their vision to that world because that is the world that brings down the oneness, the shefa, if you call it, the flow of energy from a higher world. They saw that far, but they refused to see further. And we've discussed before the reason for that. The reason for that is because seeing further requires a giving of self. The one who sees that far is because that individual wants to see to the root of where, so to speak, the goods are delivered. You don't need to go beyond that. Who owns the store? Who owns the overall department store is not relevant. Not interested in that. You're interested in the goods being delivered. So you go up to the particular, let's say, zodiac energy or the particular star or the god, the manifestation of that particular force, which is correctly transmitting that thing. But instead of seeing it as a involuntary messenger or agent, you give it credit for having some, or perhaps even ultimate, decision-making power. And that was the world of those times. That was the notion. That was the notion of idolatry. It was looking correctly to a source that is in fact a valid connector, but not seeing beyond that. What does this have to do with the eyes? What does it have to do with seeing? Why is idolatry and this kind of misperception? Why is it a misperception with the eyes? This you have to understand. First of all, you know that if you read carefully in the text of the Torah, you'll find that it all goes back to the eyes. The first sin, right? Adam and Eve, Adam and Chava. It says, "Vatere Ha'isha," the woman saw. Actually, the deeper sources say it began with a man's thoughts. But the first thing that came into manifestation was her vision. Vatere, she saw the fruit of the tree. And that was a wrong seeing. It led to the whole process that caused the downfall of the world. By the golden calf, incidentally, it says the people saw. The people saw that Moses was late. It began with a perception, a misperception. And then they saw a vision of his death. They saw an illusion. They saw the negative forces, negative energy in the world, set up an image of his burial. And real perception led to misperception. I mean, real perception is simply the fact that he wasn't where he was supposed to be, according to their calculation. So that sin of the golden calf, which was a moment of fall, just like Adam's fall. The golden calf was a moment where the Jewish people almost reached back to the level of Adam before the sin. And just like he broke the world down into the world of death and destruction, they broke it down again then. And again it began with vision. And later the verse says, Shema Tisai Enecha Shamaima, lest you lift your eyes to the heavens, says quite explicitly, lest you lift your eyes to the heavens. V'ra'isas HaShemesh V'sha'yareach, you see the sun and the moon called Tzva Shemaim and all the hosts of the heavens, and then you bow down to them. Ishtachavisalem, you start bowing down to them. The verse warns, but you have to potently, powerfully, sharply. The verse begins with "lest you shall see." It doesn't warn, don't bow down to the stars and the zodiac and the planets. It says, in case you look up to the heavens and see. The problem begins with seeing wrongly. And then mysteriously, the verse also talks about the correction in seeing and seeing the planets as well. Se'u marom enechem, it says. Lift up your eyes to the marom, the heights. Uru'u mi boro ele, and see who created these. So you have an interesting process. The problem in the world begins with seeing. I mean, we're having here an abstract discussion this evening. Right? Completely abstract discussion about the deepest level of a thing called seeing. But obviously, I presume it doesn't need to be pointed out that the personal homework here is to translate it into practicality, obviously. If you're a person of refined sensitivity, then you'll translate it into an inner seeing and try to correct that. And if you're a person of doesn't have time or interest for the inner subtleties, then of course there's plenty of outer seeing that needs to be corrected. Plenty. But let us discuss it in its root at least. I presume the practical message for those who insist on taking home a practical message will be richly obvious. How to see, that's what we want to study this evening. How to look, how to see, how not to see. How to see in, how to see through. What is this process that the world's downfall is due to seeing? And this golden calf, second version of the downfall begins with seeing. And the problem is that in this idolatrous mode, you might look up at the stars and then you might bow down to them. And then again, you have to look at the stars correctly. Again, see them, but this time correctly. What exactly does it mean? The concept of seeing is like this. Essentially different from hearing it, and essentially different from all the other senses. You know, each sense in the body, we have such a deep involuntary acceptance of secular notions. It's very hard for us to see things correctly. We think the body has five senses. Why? Because so after a few million years of bumping into each other in the trees, that's the way we are. But it's a tragedy for a Jew to think that way. Of course we got things from the animal world. Of course the Midrashim say it's quite right that we are a composite of the entire animal world. Not the way they say, obviously. But nevertheless, not only the animal world, we're a composite of the whole physical world. But the reason we have five senses is because each one is a unique focus in the body. Each sense teaches something. Like each tiny detail in the body teaches a deep spiritual lesson that no other part teaches. That's why it's there. Every part of the body, you learn tremendous. You learn all you need to know about the spiritual world from the body. You don't need more than that. What do you learn from the senses? Each sense teaches a unique message. Seeing is something that no other sense can do. Let's try and analyze this. One of the unique features of sight is that unlike, and this takes a little while to think through and to feel, but I try and eradicate from our consciousness the preconceptions in many levels, many layers. One of the things that seeing does is that it's the only sense modality that's perceived as being outside. What you see, you experience outside of yourself. All other senses take place within yourself. Right? Slowly, carefully, let's work it out. When you see something, there's many other aspects to seeing as well. Let's try and focus on them. But when you see something, you perceive the scene where it is. You don't perceive it in you. The sense organ, the organ of vision, there's no sensation in the organ. Yeah, are we making progress? Slowly, gradually. When you see something, your entire awareness, your entire consciousness of the phenomenon is where the scene is. If you see something at a distance, that's where it happens. Of course, we know that it happens through the same nerve impulses and sensory conduction mechanisms that sense and ears and smell and taste do. But the consciousness of this experience, the awareness of it, the perception of seeing, it happens outside. No other sense does that. When you feel something with your fingers, so the sensation's in your fingers. It's not outside of you. When you smell something, the sensation's in the nose. When you taste something, it's very specifically and definitely on your tongue. And the truth is, when you hear something, it happens in you. It doesn't happen at a distance. When you perceive that you've heard something from a distance, that's only because you know how to see. And I'm not talking whether your eyes are open or not. A person could be blind also, not the issue. What you're doing in that is what, when you hear sound at a distance, you're seeing with your ears. If you had no sense of vision, not because your eyes are closed, but because you've never seen, I don't mean that. If eliminated from your consciousness, it was the concept of vision. If the human being had been created without the possibility of vision, then hearing would have been in you. Am I making sense? The only reason that you perceive a sound as coming from the outside, right, or for that matter, a smell wafting in from some other place, is because you have a perception of depth. It's because you have a perception of depth. That's called seeing. The place where you register distance, okay, in the faculties, the place where you register an effect from a distance, a perception, an awareness, a sensation from a distance, is eyes. Others don't teach you that. Again, imagine you had no sense of depth to start with. No sense of externality, of that which is outside you. Imagine all you had was your locked-in awareness. Imagine, it's impossible for us to imagine that, but try. When you felt something, you would feel something moving your finger. When you smelled something, you'd sense something in your nose. And when you heard a sound, how on earth would you know that it wasn't in the ear? How could you know that? The only reason you know it's not in the ear, but it comes from a distance, and you can even tell how far away, is only because of your own awareness, and that's only because you see a world around you. I'm talking about seeing in the deeper sense. The concept is, the deeper concept in our deeper literature, is that seeing is entirely external and it's completely objective. All the rest of your experience is subjective, it's all within you. Seeing is an objective experience, it's the root of objectivity. You see, in English you call seeing is believing. Because that is defined as objectivity. Hearing is not objective. Hearing is the way you put it together in the darkness. You construct it. Seeing is like that. Seeing has the clarity. On the one hand, it has the clarity of complete objectivity and complete instantaneity. You see things instantaneously. You don't see things. The faculty of seeing is that when all elements in a scene are together, they're all objectively disposed. That's where they are. In 1 second, you see the whole scene. But you cannot hear that way. You can only hear in a sequence. The Gemara says, train Colin, ena mishtamin. Two sounds cannot be heard. Two words said together, even two, never mind more. Two words said together, they blow each other, you can't hear them. Except once in history at Sinai when the Ten Commandments all said together. It's a miraculous event. which incidentally is why it says they saw the sounds. If you want the clue. Right? When they stood at Sinai, it says they saw the sounds. Because there was no process. There was no subjectivity. There was no movement and development and calculation and construction. There everything was in one place and time. And therefore only seeing was relevant. So it says they saw the sounds. The Torah can't say they heard. Is this clear? Seeing, hearing, you can only do inside your own being in the darkness. The way you hear something, unlike a scene where all the parts are together, the way you hear something is, when I begin speaking to you, you hear the first part of the first word, doesn't mean anything to you. By the time that fades into memory and you hear the second part of the first word, the second syllable of my discussion, you still don't know what I'm talking about. You might not even know what the word is yet. By the time you hear the third syllable, the first two have faded away into memory. You still haven't an idea what I'm talking about. A long time later, when I get to the end of the sentence, or maybe the end of the paragraph or the whole story, do you become aware what the whole story means. You have to construct the whole process. Remarkable thing. That's what hearing means. That's what hearing means. That's not what seeing means. Seeing isn't like, there's no construction. I'm not talking about seeing a story. That's called listening. The unfolding of events. That's called listening. The primary mode, the absolute mode of seeing, is that you see all the parts together, there's no time sequence, it's all there. In Hebrew, in English you say seeing is believing. In Hebrew the word re'iyah, which means seeing, is re'iyah, proof. It's called a proof. That's where it is. But in listening it's not like that. In listening you hear one thing, it doesn't mean anything. You hear the next and you put them together, still doesn't mean anything. You hear the next, and only when they've all disappeared. You can't hear two of them together. It won't help you. Try and tell the whole story all in one sound. Yeah, I don't have a story. Just noise. So hearing is a construction process. That's what it is. And therefore the problem with seeing is that it's an experience, in our deeper sources it's called din. Din is the very harsh aspect of no options. The way it has to be and only that way. There's no room to move. There's no room for construction and for flexibility and for your own personal input. Din means strict justice or strict mechanical, exact, infinitely thin line. That's exactly where it is. That's what din is, and that's what seeing is. And therefore it lends itself to the problem. Because seeing a thing, when you see it at face value, you can easily see it wrong. When you see a thing the way it appears to be, and you don't see what lies behind, you don't see the construction, you're not able to put a thing together, the world tends to misrepresent itself. The nature of things in the world is that the way they present it at face value is wrong. The world presents itself as a physical place without a spiritual root. You don't see the spiritual root. You have to look deeply for that. Look at a human being, for example. In a human being, the first thing that strikes you is the physical. That's not how the human being was designed. Originally, Adam was incandescent with spirituality. When they were formed originally, the light was so powerful you couldn't see the body. If you want to know what Adam looked like, you have to picture a being who looked opposite to the way we look. The way we look is that when you see a human being, you see the body. If you want to see the light inside, the neshama, it's very, very hard. The Gemara says, basically, that the only signs of humanity that a modern human body has, of spirituality, is called ziv upon him and skip us a koma. That means the glow on the face, which Kabbalistically is a light that surrounds the human being. Ziv, it's a glow that comes out of the face. It's that inexplicable, inexpressible, intangible thing that is there 1 minute before a person dies and not there 1 minute after. Very, very slim, very faint. Animals can see that. Animals can see that. They'll come immediately near a dead body, but they won't come near. Animals wouldn't come near a living being, even if it's perfectly still. You know Joseph's dream. Do you remember Joseph's dreams? Do you remember there were two dreams? Joseph, the butler and the baker, right? They told him their dreams. One saw himself squeezing grapes into Pharaoh's cup, and one saw himself carrying 3 baskets of bread that the birds were pecking at. And the butler Joseph told he would survive, and the one who was carrying the baskets of bread, Yosef told him that in 3 days, the 3 baskets were 3 days, and in 3 days he would be killed. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. He was executed in 3 days' time. Some of our sources say, how did Joseph know how to interpret the dream? If I told you, somebody had a dream, he's squeezing grapes into a cup, because he's a butler, and another man's a baker, and he's carrying bread, would you know that the one's going to live and the one's going to die? Voshim say, Joseph knew that the baker was going to die because the birds were pecking the bread off his head. Birds don't come near living people. That means he was already dead. That means there was no aura surrounding him. Don't ask me about scarecrows. It's a this is part of the world of illusion. Even the birds are. But that faint glow on the face is very faint. Extremely faint. And the other thing is the vertical structure. The fact that a person walks upright. Not like the animal world, essentially. And those two are two separate facets of the human condition. The vertical structure is called covered. That's a certain dignity. Unlike being parallel with the ground, close to the ground. And the glow on the face is the individuality. That means there's a special look on a human face that makes no two human faces the same. Not even identical twins, but people who really know them. Of all the millions of people on earth, you pick out someone you know instantaneously. Not from the back. Not from the back. Even though from the back it may look like you can. You walk over and give them a very hearty slap and a few deep personal comments. And when they turn around, you find isn't somebody that you've ever seen before at all. That's because the back of the neck and the head may look vaguely familiar, but lots of people look. But the face, you never do that. Those are the aspects of human, but very, very faint. For the most part, the human being looks indistinguishable from an animal. Because the spiritual light inside is very faint. But when Adam was created, if you looked at him, all you saw was a spiritual light. And if you looked very carefully, you made out the wisp of a body. He looked like a very luminescent, a very bright light, where you can't make out the glass. You can only see. The perception of a person is primarily physical. Perception is not of spirituality. That's not what speaks. And the world doesn't show its spiritual roots. Therefore, the world lends itself to an idolatrous interpretation. On the contrary, the world looks much more chaotic and accidental. Snapshots taken of the world purport to show a world that is anything other than spiritual. If you have an argument with a skeptic, there's no question that the argument will be won by the skeptic. If the skeptic is demanding demonstrations and proofs of that which lies beyond that which is spiritual, what are you going to offer? Scientific proofs? You don't have any of those. It's not easy. And therefore, the problem with seeing is, for all that it's the highest sense, and for all the fact that it teaches you about an objective world, but therein lies its problem, because all it shows you is that level of objectivity. It does not show you the secret and hidden and deeper world. And therefore, the sin begins with seeing things wrongly. The way the Gemara puts it is that it traces our surah de avera. We have two agents of sin. We have two agents of sin in the world. One is the heart and one is the eyes. The heart is another discussion for another time. But one is the eyes. The eyes see things in a way that lure you into doing them wrong. If you saw them objectively, you wouldn't do that. It's because it gets wrapped in a certain way. The eyes, Vatera Ishish, she saw the fruit of the tree. It looked Nechmada Eitz. It looked beautiful. It presented itself in a certain way. She saw it in a certain way and it presented itself that way. A sarsu means an agent. He makes the sale. That's a salesman. The one of the two major sasura davera, that means the agents of sin in the world, that which leads us into badly miscalculated and mistaken areas, is because you see it wrong in the first place. How do you see it? Basically the way it looks. Yeah, if you don't have the wisdom to see beyond the way it looks. And spiritual training is a training to be able to see beneath the surface. Talmud, for example, the learning of Torah, one of the primary elements, primary methodologies in the learning of Torah, one of the most important elements in learning, is that it's a training in seeing what doesn't appear at first glance. Talmud, for example. The Talmud is training in how to think. The way the Talmud presents its arguments, the way the Gemara presents its arguments, is that it always presents what's wrong first, tries to convince you, and then when you've been thoroughly, it offers a very convincing argument, shows you where it's wrong. That's very interesting. The scientific textbooks don't do that. You don't read a textbook of geometry that purports to advance a convincing proof for a theorem and then shows you where it's wrong after three pages. It doesn't do that. But the Gemara builds up a very convincing and sophisticated argument, shows you where it's wrong. And through perceiving where it's wrong, you learn to look deeper and you have a more sophisticated construct, and three pages later you'll see where that's wrong at a more subtle level. And this is a thorough training in looking at the world and not looking at what is skin deep. Or rather, looking at what is presented on the surface, but using it to see that which is deeper. With mystical vision, with deeper eyes, you can see. The Zohar, the central Kabbalistic work, when it wants to advance a proof or demonstration, it says, Tachazi, come and see. But the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, when it wants to present an argument, it says, Tashma, come and hear. Because hearing is the work of construction. Hearing is not being fooled. Hearing is that you put it together. The downside of hearing is that it's your own subjectivity. You easily construct it wrongly. But if you're not going to learn how to construct it right, then seeing won't do it. If you take the world at face value and you look at what's skin deep and you look at what's presented on the surface of the world, it's a bit disaster. And therefore the correction for this mode of seeing is to be able to hear. It's to be able to hear. How do you do this? What does this mean? The answer is like this. Seeing is an instantaneous mode. You see a picture the way it's presented. You take snapshots of the world. If your life is a series of snapshots, there can be no meaning in it. The meaning in life is how the snapshots are connected. And that's called hearing. It's a sequence of events. Right? You know, give an example. Let's go back to the great man who taught this originally. Avraham Avinu, Abraham. Avraham. It says when he was very young. Different midrashim. One when he was 3 years old. One when he was 48 years old. But he was very young at any rate. And no one to teach him. He saw the world. And he thought this world cannot explain itself. The way the Medrash puts it is, Ra'a bira doilekes. Bira doilekes. Very interesting expression. A bira means like a palace or a building or some establishment burning. Doleket means, there are a few ways to interpret that. Doleket literally means burning. But it could mean lit up. It's usually translated as burning. Deleka means a fire. And the same root in Hebrew means to chase. Ma dalakta acharai. To chase. Incidentally, what is the connection between something that's burning and something that's chasing? Exactly. There's a process here. That's the answer. Burning is a process where that which is burnt becomes fire. It's not left behind. There's a process of one process is running itself and moving. And he looked at this process and he said, Ein birzu b'loy manik. This establishment or this fire or this lit up structure, meaning the world, could not be without a manager. B'loy manik. And then the Medrash says, God himself, Hashem himself, looked out of the window and said, Ani ba'al habira, I'm the owner of the establishment. Which means, translated in our terms, he was granted a prophetic revelation. First he calculated and realized there must be that. And then, and many, a long time later, according to most, when he was 75 years old, Hashem appeared to him and said, yes, you were right about it. Your heroism of being thrown into fire for your beliefs, all that you taught, that you did on your own calculation and your own inner knowledge, you're right, here I am. First of all, you know, it's interesting, the Medrash says that Hashem, he said, Ein birzu b'loy manhig. There cannot be an establishment like this or a building without a manager. Manhig means one who conducts its affairs. When God appeared out of the window, when Hashem put his face out, Ani Baal, I'm the owner. It doesn't say I'm the manager. Why is there a discrepancy in the Medrash? But at first level, it's like this. When he said, Ein birzu b'loy manhig, it cannot be an establishment like this without a manager. Manhig means Lashon Hanhoga. Hanhoga means that makes one event move to the next. Sequence. What he noticed about the world wasn't a snapshot of the world. What he noticed about the world was that it's a burning process, that life goes, it's burnt, each day is burnt, never to come again. But in the burning of each day, what you extract from it builds a story. And the story speaks like a story that you listen to. When you take a snapshot, there's no story, you can interpret it many different ways. But when you listen and you see one picture and then the next picture, that's called listening. When you see a picture and then the next and then the next, and you see the shift and the change. So you're listening to the story, you may be doing it with your eyes, that's not the point. But you're learning how to listen and you're learning how to put it together. In the end you see, the Baalei Musar say you should write a Megillah of your life. The word Megillah in Hebrew means to roll, scroll, and also means Megaleh, to reveal. Megalot. Because when you roll the scroll, and the classic scroll of course is Esther, which means to hide. Esther means to hide. The scroll of Esther is the classic one because in there's nothing revealed. Hashem's name not even mentioned once. All socio-political events, intrigues and palace dramas, when the whole story is told, the hand of Hashem is clearly revealed, even though it's never mentioned. So you take one event in your life and another event, your life looks chaotic. But when you write the whole story and you realize where you've come and how you got there and how unlikely was the course of your life and whom you met and what happened, that this and that coincidence and this coincidence, each one looks like a coincidence. But when you write the story and you see where those coincidences have led and where you've been led to, and you read the message correctly, it's a completely different, that is a story. That's a Megillah, that's a story. That's called hearing. What is the main mitzvah of the Jewish people? What is that which we live by? Shema Yisrael. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. What does Shema mean? Shema means to listen. But it's a tragedy to think it means, you know, how do you translate English? Hear, O Israel. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Hear, O Israel. Hashem, God, our God, Hashem Echad is one. What is exactly hear, O Israel? What does it mean, like pay attention? Is that what it means? In case you weren't paying attention. The rest of the Torah is negotiable, you can sleep. But this, wake up for one sentence. That's what the Torah means. Hashem doesn't mind if you don't listen to the rest of His Torah. That's why He doesn't say listen. Shema doesn't mean listen. Shema means construct oneness. Shema means put all the elements together. That each element is a broken fragment on its own doesn't mean anything. But put it all together. Do you know what the verb shama means in Hebrew? It means together. Vayeshama Shaul etaam, it says. Vayeshama, Saul gathered the people together. He didn't listen to anybody. He may have done that too, but that's not the point. The point is he gathered the people together. Shema means to make oneness. Shema Yisrael means, Jewish people, your work in the world is to tell the story. You testify to the story, you never leave a link in the chain out. You go back to when it happened and you keep moving that story forward. Through all the trials and traumas and brutalities and good times and bad times, mainly bad times. You tell the story. From the links in the chain, from the story being put together, is what emerges. It's called Shema. And therefore, let's try and put it together. Seeing Tammuz this month, Vayivku es haTammuz, the women cried, they mourned this demigod, semigod, prophet, whoever he was, Tammuz, who fell in this pagan, idolatrous, and they said, because of this we've lost everything. Ki chasarnu kol, we have nothing. We can't, you know, now that our worship is gone, we have nothing. Meaning nothing, the higher nothing. The higher means we have lost everything. Kol, yeah, the 50th. You know, when the golden calf was built, what did the people say? They said, Eile Elohecha Yisrael. The people said, that golden calf, at their level, if they're saying what their level was, but at their level, it was idolatrous. And they said, Eile Elohecha Yisrael, this is your God. Eile Elohecha Yisrael, this is your God, Israel, who brought you up from Egypt. Eile, the word Eile, again our deeper sources say, is half of the divine name. Elohim, the name Elohim, is spelled Mi Eile. Mi Eile. Lift up your eyes to the heavens. See who created these. Again, slowly, slowly, carefully. It's amazing to understand. What are you supposed to do is lift up your eyes and not bow down to the zodiac and the stars and think that the whole world is luck. But understand that there's something you can't see, which the face of which you're seeing. What do you say? Mi bara ele. In the English rhetorical turn of phrase, Mi bara ele means who created these? See who created these. But in Torah, of course, everything is directly meaningful. And therefore, Mi bara ele really means that Me created these. Mi bara ele. The thing called Me. What is Me? 50. Again, Mem Yud is 50. So Mi bara ele means Shem Elokim. What you're doing is when you say, see who created these, and you put the Me together with ele. The one who created these. Put those two elements together and you get Shem Elokim. And you know who created these. That's what you're saying. But when they built the golden calf, they said, Eile Elohecha Yisrael, these disparate, broken elements of the world without the Me present. That's the problem. Like Paro said, Mi Hashem. Who is he? On the contrary, Me. You know that the word Me, meaning who, when you say Me, understand this, the Hebrew expression for Me, Boro Ele, who created these, is a question like Ma, which is what? Me is who? Do you know that there's a technique in Torah, Torah expression, that when that which is infinite and transcendent needs to be expressed, obviously you can't what word can you use for that which is infinite? You can't use a word, because any word will limit your thing to that word. Again, when you want to use a word to transfer, to transmit, to convey that which goes beyond, so there's a risk that any word you use will limit. There's one technique you can use. Use instead of a word, instead of a statement, use a question. Because a question always invites more than what it says. If you, yeah, is this right? When you want to say how great is Hashem, so we say Mi kamocha ba'elim Hashem. Who is like you, Hashem? In English, it sounds like a poetic sort of a dramatic statement. Oh, who is like unto, you know? But you don't mean that. In Hebrew, you mean Mi kamocha. That means who. When you want to say that which can't be expressed, instead of saying it, which would limit it, simply ask a question instead, right? We say, Ma gadlu ma'aseach Hashem, Ma rabu ma'aseach, how numerous are your works? How great are your works? The English ear hears it as a rhetorical, how goodly and how great, Ma toivu, Ma gadlu, Ma rabu. But what it really means is that, yeah, you're using a word that is only a question, it's only an invitation for continuity. Mi boro ele means who created these, the mi, ma what, is the same numerical value as man. Ma is 45. Adam is that. The word Adam spells ma'od, which means very. The same letters that spell Adam, which means man, which also means Adamel Elyon, I will be like that which is above. The word ma'od spells very. Means always more. But the divine name, me, which is the 50, yeah, that which transcends number, so the word means who. So you say, Mi bara ele, who created these? That's what you're supposed to say when you see the stars. Instead of saying that that's as far as we can penetrate. That's what those people did. They looked into the furthest reaches of the manifest world. And they said, we can't see any further than this. This must be the point of origin. But instead of doing that, do you hear the story? Do you hear what must have been the purpose of this and the cause of this? Do you hear where it came from? What's the step that preceded this and where is it moving to? To see what's behind the scenes. To listen to the world. Instead of saying, Eile Elayacha Yisrael, this is your God, limiting it to the Eile, you have to be able to say, Mi bara ele. You know, when it says the correction, what do you have to do? You have to look up at the stars and do it right. So what does the verse say? Se'u marim einechem. Lift up your eyes to the heavens. Se'u marom einechem. Ura'u. Listen carefully to this amazing thing what the Zohar says. So... The verse says, "Se'u marom einechem." Lift up your eyes. What are eyes for? For seeing. Eyes are for seeing, right? "Se'u marom einechem." Lift up. Uru'u and see who creates thee. Said the Zohar. You take the first three letters of the first three words. "Se'u marom einechem." And it spells Shema. The same verse that's telling you to use your eyes correctly, which could be used wrongly, what it means is weave these two things together. That's what's going on. Look and see, but learn to see beyond that which can be seen. And don't be impatient. And tell the story and see what led to this and what led to that and what led to that. And where is this moving to? That's the idea of Shema. To be a Jew or to be a spiritual individual, somebody is not limited by the fragments of physical and finite space. You need to be open to the world of time. The sadness of time is that the moments that go don't come back. But the beauty of time is that as each snapshot builds a picture, and if you prepare, you hear the story. So then a Megillah gets written. And as the Megillah gets written, you learn to be more perceptive. And instead of taking snapshots, and today is only today, and then it's terribly sad because it's not here anymore, it just becomes a sweet, bittersweet memory. It has to be part of an album that tells a story. And therefore, the correction of this month, which is the difficult time again, is the time of correcting superficial vision. In practical terms, obviously, it means looking at the world correctly. Most of the work of that, obviously, is not looking, unfortunately. The way the world is set up around us is not much you can look at. But what you do look at has to be looked at not for its face value. It has to look beneath the surface. Shmiras Einayim, careful what you take in. See how it fits together, and that is the message. The fall here was caused by Vatera Isha, the wrapping, the packaging that we're fooled by. And of course, the correction is to be able not to make that mistake of Mi Eile, of the splitting them up, Eile Halecha Yisrael, not to do that, obviously, not to see it wrongly, not to see the temptation in the, or to see it for what it is, and instead perfectly harmonize these two modes. That's the mitzvah. The mitzvah is Se'u marom einechem. Lift up your eyes correctly and use the eyes. And while doing that, Se'u marom einechem Shema. Hear correctly. Okay,